And welcome back to Background Briefing. I'm Ian Masters and I'm speaking with Alan Lichtman, who is a professor of history at American University. He has studied both the American right and the presidency. His books include White Protestant Nation, The Rise of the American Conservative Movement, and The Keys to the White House, A Surefire Way to Predicting the Next President. His prediction system has correctly predicted the outcomes of all presidential elections since 1984. Thank you for joining us, Alan Lichtman.
My pleasure.
And Professor Lichtman, I wish you could have heard our first guest, Congressman Bob Filner, who was describing what happened on the night that he was elected, re-elected recently by a considerable margin. His offices were stormed by his Tea Party opponent, who beat up his staff, surrounded him.
Wow.
They cursed and screamed, called him a Jew and a traitor, terrified his family. The reason I spoke to him was I saw the footage last night on MSNBC on Lawrence O'Donnell's new show, and it was so chilling. And it reminds me, of course, of so much of what happened with Congresswoman Giffords, who, when her father was asked after the tragedy, who were her enemies, and her father said the whole Tea Party.
It's truly sad that politics should come to this, but I hate to say there is a whole tradition of this. The Tea Party did not spring full-blown out of nothingness. You can go back to the Ku Klux Klan movement of the 1920s, which was virulently anti-Semitic, of course, anti-Catholic, anti-black, anti-foreign, but also, like the Tea Party, had a major political operation. It elected thousands of local officials. It elected a number of senators, a number of governors. It declined rather precipitously, but it also was trying to hearken back to an older, more homogeneous vision of America, hence, of course, the reference to the Tea Party. That's not merely anti-tax. That's also a reference, of course, to the pioneer generation and a very different kind of America. And you could chase this through the McCarthy movement of the 1950s that caused so many people to lose their jobs or otherwise be demonized in the anti-communist frenzy of that period. And by the way, there is a history to this crosshairs that nobody has mentioned. You know, Sarah Palin's aides talk about it being a surveyor mark. Nonsense. This image had been used before to target congressmen in the 1960s by the Minutemen, an armed radical militia group that took congressmen that they felt were not sufficiently anti-communist and put crosshairs on them and said, "Beware, the crosshairs are upon you." So this is nothing new. And in choosing Sarah Palin, in choosing the term blood libel, that was utterly beyond belief. Of course, the tradition of the blood libel is that this is an old myth dating back to the Middle Ages, that Jews ritually slaughtered Christian children and drank their blood as part of their holiday rituals. There was a blood libel like this in America in the 1920s. Blood libels have been used to justify brutalization and discrimination against Jews. They were part of the Nazi philosophy. And to use this term at this time either, to me, signifies monumental ignorance or monumental hubris.
Well, Professor Alan Lichtman, it seems, though, that in contrast with Sarah Palin's speech on Facebook, which was obviously well produced and timed, the morning and then in the evening, the president's speech at the memorial. To me, it was night and day. I mean, she was so small and petty, and he was so uplifting and calling upon us all to be better and to recall the better angels of our nature. Do you think it's possible for a president to be both a moral and a political leader?
Before I answer that, let me say I agree with you about the speech, and this speech harkens back to two earlier speeches of Barack Obama. His 2004 speech before the Democratic Convention that kind of introduced himself as an inspirational politician who, as an African-American, could speak to America as a whole, and his extraordinary 2008 disquisition on race. In this speech, he did what you have to do as a president. He helped us grieve. He evoked our common bonds, and he inspired us to something beyond ourselves. And, you know, that kind of magic had been missing, and it now seems to be back for Obama. Of course a president can be both a moral and a political leader, and our greatest presidents have been both. Abraham Lincoln was a supreme politician, one of the founders of America's new party, the Republican Party, was founded 8 years before he was elected president. And yet, of course, he was a deeply introspective, moral man who was really the first president in a forthright way to confront the evils and sins of slavery. Franklin Roosevelt, a Democrat, of course. Lincoln was a Republican, was another extraordinarily shrewd and hard-nosed, practical politician. Yet at the same time, he was a great moral leader who led us through perhaps our greatest economic challenge and our greatest wartime challenge abroad. And, you know, Franklin Roosevelt also dealt with the Holocaust, which was a very difficult thing for a president to deal with in the midst of a depression and the midst of a world war. And you can see both all these priorities tugging on him as he threads his way through these very difficult moral choices. All moral choices are difficult. They all require trade-offs. They all require sacrifices. They all require some use of resources. And the test of a great president is, can you, like a Lincoln or a Roosevelt, thread your way through all this and still be an inspiration, still accomplish things, and yet at the same time, you know, recognize that you're also the head of your party and a politician?
Well, Professor Lichtman, I got this reaction from watching all of the speeches that day, starting with Palin and then ending with the president, and thinking about it, because I've been talking with a lot of people in Tucson ever since it happened, and frankly, the most powerful speech I ever saw in regard to this came from the very victim herself, who back in March, when her office was vandalized because of her vote on health care, she castigated in a very dignified way Sarah Palin for putting a target on her, both literally and figuratively, and warned Sarah Palin that there could be consequences. So it was very sad and prescient to see this. But the feeling I get is that America seems to me in many ways divided between, if you will, the dark side and the light side. And the president was all last night trying to bring us into the light, and this tortured kid that shot her and all those people represents the dark side. And I, you know, I'm not trying to conflate the kid with the Tea Party, because there's, you know, that's,
you can't do that.
That's stupid. And but even though the right wing is accusing the so-called liberal press of doing it, it just is not happening. But I do feel that the Tea Party and their activities do represent the dark side. And Palin, she was so small and petty, and Obama, by contrast, was so lofty and impressive. I just wonder whether, you know, the better angels can transcend this economic depression, and in 2012, we get the right results.
I think they can. I think America is beginning to see Sarah Palin for what she is, both ignorant and mean-spirited, and that's a very dangerous combination. Either she used the term blood libel out of sheer ignorance or out of tremendous malice, and either one, it doesn't figure well upon her. I think her approval ratings, which weren't all that impressive to start with, are going to go down in the wake of her response to this tragedy, and those of the president who really, as you said, stood above the partisan strife and appealed to what is the better angels of our nature and to what we have in common, his approval ratings are going to go up. I, as you say, have a book called The Keys to the White House, which has predicted every election since 1984, and well over a year ago, taking into account expected Democratic losses in the midterms of 2010, I predicted a relatively easy re-election victory for Barack Obama, and the keys still point very much in that direction. I think Sarah Palin is most unlikely to be nominated by the Republican Party, and if she does get the nomination, she'll be another Barry Goldwater, 39 to 40% of the vote.
Well, she's clearly running, I think, and I think that was what the timing of that her video was all about. And as well as suggesting that she's ignorant, which I think is fairly clear, the people that write her speeches, I believe they're these neocons that that are, you know, Bill Kristol and company and the former advisor to National Security Advisor John McCain's campaign, Randy Scheunemann, they're her inner circle. I was amused to see one of the responses from the former political advisor to Senator John McCain in Arizona, John Weaver, on his Facebook. The president had exactly the right tone and was pitch perfect for the nation last night. And when juxtaposed against, well, you know who, ahem. So there you have it.
Really remarkable. And, you know, in some senses, this was even a better speech than Bill Clinton's 1995 speech in the wake of the Oklahoma City bombing. But that speech was a turning and pivotal moment for Bill Clinton and the nation. We had a very similar situation. Republicans had just taken over, in this case, both houses of the Congress. The kind of Sarah Palin figure, although vastly smarter and shrewder of the time, was Newt Gingrich, who was at the time, you know, very radical, a young Turk, leading a new Republican revolution. There was a lot of rhetoric coming from Rush Limbaugh and G. Gordon Liddy and other talk show hosts that was bordering on incitement to violence. People were talking about Bill Clinton being a one-term president. He had a plead even to say the president is relevant. And there were other factors as well, but that speech at Oklahoma City, I think, was really a turning point for Bill Clinton and the nation.
So, Professor Alan Lichtman, as a presidential historian, how does Obama compare in the kind of in terms of presidential rhetoric? How does his speeches stand in the pantheon of presidential addresses? And as I mentioned in the opening of the program today, some have survived through the ages. Even at the time, they weren't appreciated or had little effect.
Correct.
I recall, for example, Gettysburg's address.
Yeah. Exactly. I would have given him relatively mediocre marks prior to this speech because I thought his two greatest speeches were pre-presidential, the 2004 Democratic Convention speech and the 2008 speech on race. I did not think his inaugural address belonged in the pantheon of great inaugural addresses like Franklin Roosevelt's first inaugural or John Kennedy's inaugural. And I wasn't all that impressed with other speeches as well, but this one I think elevates him, at least in terms of one speech, among the most magical and persuasive of our presidents. But he'll need to do more to be in the company of a Lincoln or a Roosevelt or a John F. Kennedy.
So just in closing, Alan Lichtman, do you think that the tide that is being driven by money, because clearly the Supreme Court decision made enormous difference in these midterm elections to fuel this Republican takeover of the House and increase their majority in the Senate. And, you know, a billionaire, as our previous guest, Bob Edgar, head of Common Core, said, you know, a billionaire can put $1 billion up to defeat the Democratic candidate if he wants to next time around.
Well, that's certainly true. And in fact, I've said for many years, if you want to get rich in America, don't dig for gold, don't drill for oil, make political contributions. In return for hundreds of thousands or millions in political contributions, these business groups can get billions in benefits and tax breaks. And sadly, it's not just Republicans. I'm no big Ralph Nader fan in terms of his campaigns, but he has a point when he says both parties are beholden to corporate interests. Let's not forget the Democrats had the House, they had the Senate, they had the President for 2 years, and they could not even confront what I think is perhaps humanity's most daunting challenge, and that is getting off the fossil fuel economy. Yes, for global warming, but also for national security, also for the environment, also for the economy. This is perhaps our most urgent task, and the best the Democrats could come up with was a pathetic cap-and-trade bill, which had failed in Europe, and they couldn't even get the Senate approval for that. So I would not, unfortunately, limit the influence of corporations and corporate lobbies and corporate monies just to one part of it. They have our whole government tied up, and you know that I think is one of the biggest problems we have in this country. And given these Supreme Court decisions and the composition of the court, Ian, there's no easy solution to it, and we're not going to get complete public financing.
Well, I thank you for joining us today in Los Angeles, Professor Alan Lichtman.
Anytime. Take care.
Thank you. I've been speaking with Alan Lichtman, who's a professor of history at the American University. He studied both the American right and the presidency. His books include White Protestant Nation, The Rise of the American Conservative Movement, and The Keys to the White House, a surefire way to predicting the next president. His prediction system has correctly predicted the outcomes of all U.S. presidential elections since 1984.